Yeah, there's another story. You know, like I said, I've had a very rich career. I'll have to say I've just had some phenomenal things happen, especially when you work in a busy system on the strip and in the streets of Las Vegas. I've been a STIP fire station captain before I took the MSG's job a year ago. And I had a wonderful crew. It's a Station 94 at Henderson Fire Department. And I had a lot of guys that were there that were just, you know, the team approach and everybody looking out for each other there and the quality of the medicine and certainly the quality of compassion and care that went on with those guys was just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Now, I was fortunate enough, too, that I trained my crew really well. I trained an actor to fill my role when I was gone or for any reason I would be incapacitated that the crew would be able to continue to function. And I guess going back to that mentor relationship that you asked about earlier, yeah. You know, this guy I tried to mentor, and by far I would say that he'll be an exceptional fire captain someday as soon as he, you know, achieves the, you know, just makes it in the right place on the test. But as far as compassion goes, again, this crew is exceptional what they did. And there was, so a lot of times what I would do is I'd try to give everybody opportunities. And then one of the things is that being a fire captain, you know, a lot of times you got to sit in the command seat. You don't always get the luxury of being able to do patient care anymore. And there was a lot of times where I would, you know, I missed patient care. I missed that interaction, that human piece. So on occasion I would treat myself by jumping on the rescue and being the paramedic and letting one of the actors step up to be the commanding officer on the engine. And I would do that frequently on the holidays as a treat to myself. And about 4 or 5 years ago on Christmas Eve, I did that and I stepped up and I said, you know, I'm going to ride the rescue today. You know, you guys can decide who wants to be the captain today and I'll get on the rig with a good friend of mine or a good paramedic and good colleague, a guy named Jimmy Petrolia. And let me kind of clarify about Jimmy Petrolia. It's a guy that, it's an interesting guy, a good public servant guy, but he's a bad boy. And he's a bad boy because he comes from the military. He's a PJ right now. So not only does he maintain his job at the Henderson Fire Department, but he works with the Air National Guard out of the San Francisco area.
Okay.
And he's been deployed to the Middle East several times, but he's with that PJ team. That's there's only a couple of Air National Guard PJ teams or pararescue guys around the country. And he's fortunate enough to be belonging to one of those services. Jimmy's got a couple of kids and a lovely wife, good family. And during his time, as you probably will be aware, as you travel through this career, you'll notice that the military medics, you know, they're really great with trauma because that's what they see.
Yeah.
But a lot of times there's weaknesses in the medical aspects of their assessments and certainly a lot of issues about dealing with elderly people because not all the time do they get to see those folks in their military practice. So I was on the rig that day. The first call we went on in the afternoon, we had an elderly guy that had a seizure or had reported seizure activity. And when we got there, you know, the engine rolls up and they assisted us and we started assessing this guy and really couldn't figure out, you know, if he had a primary seizure history, but he just looked bad. His color wasn't good. And we had just gotten capnometry placed on the rigs. And not only did we have the end-tidal for the endotracheal tubes, but we also had the nasal cannulas that have the little,
sensor on it.
So, and he hadn't used that stuff before and he really wasn't comfortable with his interpretation of waveform. So I hooked it up and showed him how everything was going and kind of showed him, you know, this is what the waveform looks like. This is a prolonged expiratory phase. And, you know, this, it turned out the guy's PCO2 wound up being like in the 50s or 60s, you know, so he was sick.
Yeah.
And that's what he had a hypoxic seizure. So we went ahead and, you know, started a couple, and it turned out that, you know, his lung sounds, we couldn't hear real well because of the engine noise. And then by the time we got him in the back of the truck, we realized that, you know, it was just a bad case of exacerbation of COPD and he had pneumonia. So after we opened up with a couple albuterols, you know, he kind of pinked up and, you know, he got all, you know, his level of consciousness came back up to the point where he's oriented instead of just slightly disoriented. And then obviously his color improved dramatically. So, Jimmy got to see how the capnography worked and, you know, all the diagnostics that are on the LIPAC 12 that a lot of times we ignore.
Yeah.
So the next call, we go back to the station, we eat some dinner and right after dinner, a call comes in just a couple blocks down from the station for a guy that, fell. And we get to the house, and it's a second floor apartment. Walk up to the second floor apartment. There's an elderly couple up there, like one of those couples that I previously described. Yeah. Married 50 years, you know, nice couple. And the husband's just laying on his bed. And again, it's my treat to be on the rescue. So I started assessing him, and he said that he had went to take the garbage out and he tripped over a speed bump that was out in the parking lot. And he just had a ground level fall, and he got up, threw his garbage out, walked back up a flight of stairs to the second floor apartment, and his side hurt a little bit. So he went ahead and laid down, and his wife got a little concerned. So she called the ambulance, and his vital signs were all stable. His lung sounds were clear on both sides, and there was just this little bit of tenderness on his left chest wall where he had impacted the speed bump, but no crepitus. You know, when we talk about, it was just only slightly tender to palpation, and the guy was in pretty good health otherwise. No, he'd been a past smoker. His wife had told us that he had smoked for about 50 years. He was on no meds, and again, generally a pretty healthy dude. Mm-hmm. But when I was listening to his lung sounds again, you know, I listened to all six fields, and on the, instead of on the left side where the impact was, on the right side, I noticed what I would consider a pretty rare, lung sound. And a lot of students aren't, you know, they're only taught now the difference between crackles and wheezes. And
yeah.
I never really accepted that in the curriculum changes. So I always taught people about fine rails, coarse rails, and I certainly taught them about all the other kind of weird sounds that you'll hear on the right. chest. And one of them in particular, I think, is a pleural friction rub. And a lot of times you'll hear that in a cancerous patient or somebody with asbestosis or somebody with, you know, silicosis, in a lot of those kind of scleritic tissue injuries that can occur from inhalation injuries. And I noticed that just on the slight right side of his chest where they're well, the opposite side of the injury. And knowing the guy had had a pretty significant history of being a smoker, I was suspicious that, geez, maybe we stumbled across a cancer here. Mm-hmm. So even though he's elderly, and again, the fact that, you know, somebody called because they sensed that something wasn't right.
Right.
You know, and that's something that we really don't take into consideration a lot of times is, you know, generally that generation doesn't want to bother the system. So when they do call, you know, you really have to be thorough and looking through and being a good detective and getting a lot of history and having a thorough physical exam, because it's very easy to miss something.
Right.
And, you know, again, this guy got a complete head to toe survey and palpation of his abdomen and chest wall. And then again, a good thorough assessment of his lung sounds. So, we convinced him that he needed to go to the hospital for that chest x-ray. And again, this was starting to be about 8, 9 o'clock at night on Christmas Eve. So he actually insists on walking down the stairs. So we walked him down to the gurney, sat on the gurney, and we put him in the back, and the engine cleared, and the paramedic that I told you that I recently kind of gave some education to on the waveform wound up, you know, plugging in the capnometer and then the, you know, lip checking his capnometry again, just for, you know, cause he was fascinated with the new technology and then checked the pulse ox. And it turned out that his sats were down around 90. So he put some oxygen on him, went ahead and put a lock in him, and, we started down the hospital, and, you know, again, he was talking to him, and the guy seemed like he was fine.
Yeah.
And he had told us, you know, that, you know, he was originally from Chicago and had been a jeweler there and pretty active history in his life. And, you know, had three sons, and they were on their way down to meet him at the hospital. So we get to the hospital, and in a typical Las Vegas hospital is overcrowded and not a lot of beds that are available for patients. So the nurse initially directed us back to the a room that was not a monitor bed. And we told her, well, you know, this guy, you know, his sats were a little bit low. He probably needs to be out someplace where he can be on a pulse ox and on a monitor. And she says, well, I'll move him out as soon as I get a bed. You know, I'm freeing up a bed here shortly. So we put him in the back room that's kind of like a cast room with no equipment like that. And then as soon as we got him moved over to the bed, we got another call. And, you know, we could have easily let another rig take it, but, you know, again, it was my treat to be on the rescue that day. So I want to make sure I maximize the number of calls I got. So we left without having our paperwork done. And we got out of there and got about halfway to the call, and the engine winds up canceling us that they didn't need the rescue on this one or need a transport. So we turned around to go back to hospital to finish out the paperwork. Now, when we got back to the hospital, this guy was, my partner went to fetch, you know, the face sheet so he could start on the paperwork. And all the demographics for the patient. And I walked by to see where he'd been put. And the nurse had wheeled him out to a monitor bed and hooked him up to the monitor and all the machinery. And again, they were pretty busy. So she just hooked him up and walked away. But when I walked by this guy this time, he was a totally different guy. And it was the most subtle of changes that I think that you can ever come across. And one of the very first things that you see in shock that an experienced provider will start to pick up is a patient starting to get restless. And long before they get tachycardic and long before they get hypotensive or get cyanotic, they'll start to get restless. And this guy was restless. He was in the bed. He was kind of flailing around a little bit. And I wouldn't even call it flailing. I would just call him that he is a guy that looked uncomfortable as compared to being the cool, calm, and collective, talkative guy that we saw and that we dropped off 20 minutes earlier.
Fidgeting, shuffling around.
Yeah, just in that whole description of anxious and apprehensiveness that you got to see when somebody's in the early phases of shock. Now, I started looking at the guy and I said, that is not the same guy we saw 20 minutes ago. Something's not right here. And so I cycled the DynaMap and the blood pressure cuff and it came back and the pressure was 60 over 40. And frequently, you know, the blood pressure cuffs are inaccurate.
Yeah.
So I cycled it again. I started looking at his heart rate and his heart rate was in the like 68. And I'm thinking to myself, I said, this guy's in shock, though. I mean, he's anxious, he's apprehensive, and his blood pressure's coming back low. So I call my partner over. We start putting another IV in. I tell the nurse, I said, you better get the doctor over here and look at this guy. I said, he's going downhill. He's in shock and something's not right here. So I start looking. I'm thinking, well, why is he not tachycardic? And you start going back and you start thinking, well, you know, what other kind of conditions will cause shock when the heart rate won't respond? And, you know, sometimes neurogenic shock will pop up like that. You know, you won't get the tachycardia with that. And then I start thinking to myself, I wonder what kind of medications he's on. And I said, I wonder if he's on a beta blocker. And sure enough, he was. So the beta, you know, what you'll find in a lot of standardized curriculums, especially the GEMS curriculum, is that a lot of medications sometimes will mask the symptoms of shock. And that's exactly what was going on with this guy. He was in shock and he was on a beta blocker. And he also had a calcium channel blocker for his blood pressure.
Double whammy.
So he couldn't compensate for the shock issue. So we got a second line put in and we gave him a fluid challenge, turned his oxygen up, switched him over from a cannula to a mask. And doctor orders a stat chest x-ray and comes over and he says, man, it looks like he's got something going on his left side, you know, where that pain was.
Right.
And he says, but the tech that shot the x-ray was pretty bad at the x-ray that night. So he's like, well, you know, there's shadow here. It could be blood. It could be a pneumo. He says, I got to call for a CAT scan. So immediately calls for a stat CAT scan and also calls for a surgeon. Now, again, it's Christmas Eve, man.
Right.
So we're standing there watching this thing and we're monitoring the guy. And as soon as we got a fluid challenge on him and turned up his O2, you know, he kind of came back around. Now, the whole time his sons are kind of standing in the background watching this thing go on. So about 30 minutes into this, the CAT scan technician had not acknowledged the call or the page, and the surgeon had not returned the phone call. So the ER physician comes over and looks at us and says, man, this guy's going to die in here, man. I think he's bleeding. And I said, you know what? I said, we brought him. We got the rig outside. I said, why don't we just load him up here and we'll take him to the trauma center. He says, well, you know, I need to probably call a helicopter or a CCT, man, because I think he needs some blood. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, man. I said, I got a military medic with me. He's given blood a dozen times in the field under more battle stress conditions than this. And I said, if you'll write the order for us to deviate from the protocol and you'll take responsibility for it, we'll take the blood and the blood tubing and we'll get him out of here right now. And you'll call, if you can call the trauma center. And the doc looks at us and says, yeah, I think that's probably a good idea. And I'll take responsibility for it. And I think that's a key point, because if you're going to deviate from protocols, you're definitely going to need a physician to back you up on this.
Yeah.
So from an experience standpoint, I mean, we could have run out of there with him and violated a million Intala laws and the whole interfacility transport issue. And then again, the ethical question about whether you can handle blood as basic medic or not. Now, certainly a lot of critical care paramedics will do that, but certainly the military medics are very good at it.
Right.
So we started up the road, 30 minutes.
I'm just going to interrupt for a second, but I think one of the other things that that points to as well was the level of communication that you were maintaining with the hospital staff. And, you know, everybody was working together to get a real good picture, and you were able to communicate, you know, what your capabilities were.
Right.
And the hospital, the doc was able to say, well, this is what I'm concerned about and this is what I got going on. And everybody was really listening to each other. And that's a very positive.
And I'll have to say that, you know, the physicians, that physician that night and the physicians generally at that ER had known me for 20 years. And, you know, that certainly there's a level of trust that gets built between experienced medics that, you know, physicians learn to rely on. And, you know, I think that, you know, had the, there not been a personal relationship there between me and the physician or that over that long period of time, that might not have been an option.
Right.
But again, there's a level of trust that goes with that too. So we start up at the trauma center. It's probably a good 25 minutes up there. We give the guy a unit of blood on the way up and another unit of saline and monitors vitals. And when we roll into the trauma center at that point, the guy's looking great. You know, he's talking, he's pink, he's warm, he's got good peripheral pulses, pressure's great. So we hand the x-rays off to the trauma surgeon, who's kind of a crusty old gal, you know, you know, one of those typical Trapper John type people that's going to always, you know, be riding or, you know, riding you around like a Shetland pony, no matter what, just because, you know, they're grumpy and they're overworked. And that's the thing about trauma docs is you got to realize that, man, they're on their feet for a long period of time. And when they do got to open somebody up, you know, it's hours. And, you know, it takes a lot of physical stamina to be a trauma doc and certainly a trauma surgeon. So she's kind of grumpy wandering around there and she throws up the first chest x-ray and makes a lot of rude comments about whoever shot that was incompetent. And she says, but I do see something kind of here. And, you know, just to get a clearer picture of this, let's reshoot the chest x-ray. And while we're waiting, we'll roll the guy over to the CT and get a CT scan. And of course, the trauma center's got technicians right there in the ER.
Right.
So she's looking at us. She's like, there's nothing wrong with this guy. And I said, you know, I had to tell you, doc, I said, you know, this guy had me a little bit scared. And I'm telling you that there's something going on with him. He's in shock and, you know, he's going to give you a little bit of a surprise. And she says, well, we'll see. So about 10 minutes later, the CAT scan technician calls over and says, hey, I need a doctor over here. This guy's not doing well. So she finishes the scan. They come wheeling him over, and he's basically having agonal respirations, laying flat on the gurney.
Jeez.
And I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, smoker, 70-something years old. Or he's this isn't good.
Lights
out. So the CAT scan technician comes over immediately and says, man, he's got a big hemopneumo on that left side. So trauma doc comes over, puts his chest tube in, takes about 700 cc's of blood out of his left chest wall.
Wow.
So, you know, we were there and watched that whole thing go down. He winds up getting a rapid sequence intubation, get put on the vent. I'm thinking to myself, well, not a really good Christmas for this guy.
No.
So we stayed, and as soon as they kind of decided to take him over surgery and explore what was going on, and what had happened is one of his floating ribs had wound up puncturing something and got a vessel and wound up giving him a hemopneumo on that situation. So we finally left, went and got ourselves a couple of sodas. By this time, it's about midnight rolling around. So, you know, 12 o'clock hits for Christmas and you're kind of just thankful about, you know, all the other good things in life. So about a week later, we're all kind of sitting in our loungers at the fire station on New Year's Day, waiting for, you know, waiting for whatever football game was coming on that day.
Right.
And we all ate and had a pretty easy day.
Nap
doorbell
time.
Rings about 3 o'clock and we open the door and lo and behold, it's this guy with his three sons. So he had only wound up being intubated for a couple of days, made a complete recovery, had his, couple of stitches in the side where his chest tube was. And, they really, all they needed to really do was go in and cauterize the small vessel that
right.
was producing all that blood and tie it off. And, you know, he was moving a little slow, but he was there with his wife of 50 some years and his three sons. And they were all very grateful about everything that had happened. They'd seen what had happened, the whole process, because they were kind of witness to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a great Christmas gift.
That's
so
great.
So when I wound up leaving, Henderson Fire about in November of last year, November of 06. And I called the guy up and said, hey, you know, I'm leaving. I'm going to another department. And, you know, I really want to tell you, you know, you're probably one of the best calls I had in my career as far as making sure that everything is refined with my assessment skills and, you know, picking up some of the subtle things that happened to you. And he says, oh, yeah. And I said, well, would you mind if we come over and just had a picture? So I drove over and he came down and stood out by the engine, got a picture with the crew and, you know, said, hey, thanks a lot again. And said, you know, good luck to you and waved goodbye to him and kept the picture and you know, kept the memory. So,
yeah.
But again, it goes back, I think, a lot to the issue of kind of realizing, again, the very subtleness of shock. Mm-hmm. And then having that high index of suspicion. And then the other issue is, again, you know, there's people that you look at and say, you know, they're pretty hardy folks. Why would they call 911?
Right.
You know, what's going on here that made them decide to push those numbers on the phone to call 911?
Right.
And a lot of times people don't necessarily see that. You know, they don't see the big picture. And a lot of times they don't get to the detective work. And a lot of times they take the shortcut on the assessment piece. And when really, you know, the whole piece of the laying of hands and getting your hands on the patient to palpate and auscultate is really a big deal. I mean, in itself, the whole laying of hands or the touching of the patient, you know, for an assessment standpoint, not only one has its own healing properties, but it also has the confidence that in yourself and also from the patient that somebody with some knowledge and skills and ability is assessing them and that their trust in their life is being placed in their hands.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FISDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.